I can I just say as well, I thoroughly enjoyed doing this last time, and it's great fun, isn't it? Yeah, that's our intro, by the way, to episode two.
I wasn't recording on my side. Hello, and welcome to episode two of the PR Hub podcast. I'm Adam Tuckwell.
And I'm John Wilcox.
And thanks for joining us. Hopefully many of you had an opportunity to listen to our first podcast, but if you didn't, welcome to the show. This is a new endeavour for us. We've been running PR networking groups in Cambridge for 5 years, but we've started out in podcasting. And the purpose really is to create a fun and engaging podcast experience for people where we can learn from one another, we can share news and insights, but critically, we can interview interesting people so we can all learn from each other.
And now that we've got the first episode under our belts, and our thanks once again to Becky Hall for being our sort of first interviewee, and we're all set and ready for episode two, I think we should introduce ourselves.
Good idea.
Case, in case you don't know us in person, having been to a PR Hub event in Cambridge. I'm John. I am Senior Communications Manager at a video games company based in Cambridge. I've got 14, 15 years under my belt in journalism and PR. That's it from me, really.
That's a deep introduction, John. A deep introduction.
Yeah.
Well, I'll cut in and say I'm Adam. I'm the Client Partnership Director at Mobas, which is an integrated agency in Cambridge. I was working in-house for 10 years in a variety of comms role, one of which was working with John, which is where we met, and then working in an education company, a publishing company, before moving into agency 3 years ago. And I haven't quite got as much experience as John, but I'm still clocking up the years. I've been quite heavily involved in the CIPR. I'm a fellow of the CIPR, and I've also acted as regional chair for the CIPR for 3 years in East Anglia. So between us, John and I have got a really good understanding of the region, but also the industry as a whole, with a mix of journalist background, agency background, and in-house roles under our belts.
Cool, that was a great intro. You put me totally to shame there. I mean, you know, I could have said about working in the video games industry as a journo for a few years.
It's the danger of going first, John.
It's true. It's absolutely true. There's all sorts I could have spoken about, you know, being a B2B tech journalist, and then, you know, flipping the coin and coming to the dark side of PR. Although Mike Sargent, who is our guest on today's show, argues that PR is in fact the light side, and it's journalism that is the dark side. So spoiler as to who are
spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. So yeah, Mike Sargent will be our guest today. But yeah, I could have spoken about all that, but I didn't. And instead, you put me to shame.
That's okay. There's always an opportunity for people to get to know us a little bit better as we proceed. But I imagine most people are listening because of the quality of the people we're interviewing and our insight on the news rather than who we are and our experience. So we'll carry on with the show and perhaps have an opportunity in later episodes to dig a bit deeper into what it means to move from being a journalist to a PR practitioner, as that's certainly a hot topic for PR practitioners. And it'll be interesting to see what journalists make of that too.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, as I said, our guest today is going to be Mike Sargent from Sargent Leadership Communications. You'll be hearing more about him later in the show. But, you know, enough about, you know, Adam and me. Let's just talk to the news. Talk to the news? Talk about the news.
Here's the news. Well, since we've last recorded our podcast, it's been a bumper news for PR and comms practitioners. There's been an awful lot, and when John and I were preparing, we've spent a lot of time crawling across the internet trying to see the bigger stories, or the ones which we think are the most engaging. So while sometimes we might factor and speak about big deals or changes of leadership at particular agencies or comms roles, we've tried to pick out some interesting ones, and I think for this episode there's a couple which will really resonate with many of our listeners. So I'm gonna go first, John, if that's okay.
By all means.
So we were very excited because the CIPR's annual State of the Profession report has come out today. And the report is a combination of a huge piece of research that's been done by members of the CIPR, adding, answering surveys, answering questionnaires, and giving their impartial and anonymous insight into the state of the profession, which the CIPR then populate into a chunky report that runs to about 40 pages. So we've taken some time today to try and digest it, and there are a few things that really jump out. I don't know what it says about me, but the first thing I always do is jump to the salary section to see how much I should be getting paid. And it's interesting that the average salary for full-time comms employees has risen this year, which is positive, by almost £1,500. And the average salary now is £53,044 per year for a practitioner. Now, that's quite high, I think. And I think that probably tells you quite a lot about, A, the type of people who fill in the CIPR State of the Profession survey and their level of seniority, and also tells us a lot potentially about the regional makeup of people who contribute this survey. As we know, as we're close to London, the closer you are to London, the higher paid you are. But I think that's interesting. But it's really important not to be bogged down with just the salary data and really look at some additional insight in the report. And there's an awful lot there to digest, and there's lots to talk about with regards to where people work, what they're doing. There's a lot in the report about gender, and there's also a big chunk in the report about diversity. And when we talk about diversity, as we mentioned on our first podcast, which you can still listen to, we talked a lot about a campaign by Sarah Hall to try and get more diversity in comms, to get more state-educated people into PR so that it's not continuing to be filled with privately educated white people, and to be more diverse. But the thing that I really wanted to talk about for this episode was some worrying insight that has come around to the topic of mental health and mental health issues facing the profession. And people have been extremely honest and open and upfront in the report, and there are some worrying statistics from what's come back. We know that, I think it's a positive thing that people are more comfortable talking about mental health issues now than they certainly have been in the past. But one stat really jumped out for me, and that's the fact that 23%, just under a quarter of practitioners, have said that they've had to take time off for sickness from work on the grounds of stress, anxiety, and depression. And I think that's really, interesting. That it's worrying, but I think it's positive that people can talk about it. And I guess there are different levels of extreme. John and I were talking before we were recording the podcast about the fact that with mental health, we're all on a scale. And it goes up and down for many of us. But a worrying 63% of respondents rated the stressfulness of their job as 7 out of 10. And I just wanted to talk about that from our experience, John. What do we make of that statistic? But also, what can employers do to try and mitigate that, or to manage the level of stress for people that are working in comms, which is, you know, a high pace, high stress environment? Are we doing enough as a profession to look after each other?
First of all, you're absolutely correct. I think in choosing this story, mental health is mental health awareness is increasingly on people's radars, and I don't think by any stretch of the imagination is that exclusive to the comms profession. In fact, I'd be very interested to know where the sort of stressfulness rating of the comms industry rates when compared to other industries. So I think that's very interesting. I think it's very interesting to see people come forward and admit it. I think that hopefully mental health awareness is have an effect in decreasing any stigma attached to mental health, and as you said, it's a scale. Everybody gets affected by it. Nobody's impervious to it, you know, I think it's great that the report asks these sorts of questions of its practitioners. Mm. I'd be intrigued to sort of know, you said about the seniority potentially of the salary earlier on. Now, if it's skewed higher because of more senior practitioners taking part in the salary, taking part in the survey with higher salaries, are they feeling more stress than junior practitioners who perhaps aren't filling in the survey?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting point. I think there are significant stress points for people at all levels. My gut initially says that, of course, as more senior practitioners now in our career, it's easier to think that life is more stressful. But I remember one of my first PR jobs, and my job was to phone up 10 journalists and speak to them on the phone about something which I knew wouldn't be very interesting to them. And I was doing it because I was told to do it. I knew that when I woke up that morning, that was going to be the job that faced me for that day. And it's an extremely stressful thing to do. And I think there are different points throughout our career journey and through our learning journey where we have these episodes of stress. It might be, you know, fear of failure. It might be concerns or pressures around delivering work to deadlines. But I think there's a real problem. I think it's certainly very interesting to think about the fact that the stigma associated with mental health concerns is changing, which I think is really positive. But there is a real worry about the level of stress that there is within the profession. I think mm-hmm. what we need to do is not necessarily expect employers to make wholesale changes, which might be difficult for them to do. But I think what we do need to do is just be more open with ourselves and find opportunities to talk to our peers and our line managers about how we feel. And I think there are key stress points. A lot of people in the report, it's quite interesting, 63% of respondents rated stressfulness of their jobs at 7 out of 10. And the things that cause that are unsociable hours, unrealistic expectations and heavy workloads. And those are all things that can be challenged. Those are all things which can be overcome if we work with our teams, if we work with our leaders, and we educate people as to what PR is. And I know that's a big focus for the CIPR to try and professionalise our profession and try and increase board level understanding of what it is that we do. And I think that helps. I think expectation management can really help reduce pressure and stress. But I think it's a really worrying statistic. But I think it's also really healthy that people are talking about it at this time. And I think it's definitely something we want to talk about more, perhaps in another episode or find someone to interview on the topic. Because I think we all need to be really mindful of it. And it's worrying to read. But if it forces us to act, then it can only be a good thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, you said about what can employers do about it as well. And I think there has to be a level of support for staff. You know, it is not cheap to go and see a counsellor privately, and God knows that waiting times to speak to an NHS counsellor can be, you know, 1 year, 18 months, 2 years, which for you know, some people can be, you know, too long to bear. So I think it's great that the CIPR in its survey has asked the question. It's excellent and very positive that people feel comfortable enough, even though it's an anonymized survey, to admit themselves and therefore confirm it in a survey that they are under pressure, in this case work-related pressures. And you're quite right as well about managing expectations, you know, crunch, meeting deadlines and things. These can all expand and add to a work-life imbalance. And I think that has to be recognised, and I think senior management needs to find a way to support staff of all levels to ensure that, you know, if their mental health is suffering, that, you know, it's properly and professionally dealt with. Because, you know, thinking not selfishly from a corporate point of view, but ultimately, if you have mentally unwell staff members who are struggling, they're not going to be performing to the best of their abilities, you know, away from the sort of the personal empathy that companies should be showing. It should also be, I'm sure they are also mindful that you know, the mental health of their staff is of paramount for the business too.
That's really good. It's really good advice there. And I think what I'd strongly encourage everyone to do is to go to the CIPR website and download a copy. The report is there. It's free to download. It's not behind a paywall or a registration wall or anything. So you can go to the CIPR website and download it. There's a new story on the front page if you're quick to act. Otherwise, you'll be able to find it on the website. And there's lots of information there. And what I'd encourage you to do is not just to download it to look at your salaries and see if you're above average for where you work in the region that you work for your role, but to really act upon the insight that's in there. There's some really interesting information, not just about the mental health piece that we've talked about, but also the fact that the industry is two-thirds female, but men occupy just under half of the industry's senior positions. There are things that we all need to do to read and act. And I think it's sad that quite a lot of these facts do not come as a surprise. I think perhaps 2019 could be the year that we sort of pick up the mantle and start to make a positive change and ensure that our industry is a beacon of positivity for the future would be good. If this report could do one thing, it would be good to encourage more diversity, more women in leadership roles, but also ensure people are paid a fair salary, but in a working environment that doesn't cause difficulties and problems for their health. I think that would be a very important message, and I'm sure the CIPR would be pleased if that were a result of their endeavours.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And you know, it'd be great to sort of see what the 2020 survey says, and hopefully we'll see a reduction in some of those figures. You know, help is available, and get that support.
That's good advice. There's one other piece in the report that I think is interesting, and that's around the challenges that face the industry. And I think looking at these, there are 11 of them listed, or they rank 11 issues and challenges that face the industry, which would make very good podcast topics, each and every one of them. It's interesting that the highest concern or the biggest challenge that people have identified is the changing social and digital landscape of communication. So I think it's something that we need to think about in terms of having a look at the challenges and ensuring each of us are prepared for the world of future comms. So perhaps we'll do an episode on that in the future as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, that's a really fascinating topic. I mean, I think, you know, the last 15, 20 years, we've seen an incredible change of pace in the landscape. Things are changing and moving faster than ever before. And it can be an incredible challenge to even try to keep up with the pace of change. So yeah, I think we should definitely get a few people on. Let us know if you'd like to come on and chat about your thoughts on the social and digital landscape in the comms industry and the challenges that we are all facing in the coming years ahead.
Fantastic. John, you've got our second story for us to discuss.
Yeah, so second story that jumped out at me this time around came off the back of my interview with Mike Sargent, which is coming up later on. Now, he's got a new book coming out on the 18th called PR for Humans, How Business Leaders Tell Powerful Stories. And it kind of just led me to sort of think about PR and communications place in the sort of corporate space or any sort of company space, really, in that you know, should or does and should PR have a seat at the leadership table, and also if not, you know, why not, and what can we do to help business leaders acknowledge the importance of PR in helping them succeed, and, you know, all that sort of good stuff. So for me, the story that jumped out came at the end of last month. It's on prnewsonline.com from Melissa Hoffman. She's got a great piece up on social and digital KPIs to prove PR value to the C-suite. Now, I am sure that this won't come to a shock to any of our listeners, but sometimes business leaders don't necessarily perceive PR to have a value to the wider business.
No way.
I know. And, you know, I think a lot of that is down to the historic issues surrounding, well, basically attaching value to PR output. I think that, you know, the ongoing requirement for some companies to see AVEs, for instance, of a campaign, when the industry has spent an awful long time and an awful lot of time trying to dissuade clients and, you know, if you're in-house, the sort of executive leadership from they want them to sort of move away from that sort of metric. But then, of course, the challenge has been, well, if you're getting rid of it, what KPIs, what metrics do we use? And importantly, how can they be of use to companies when it comes to making business decisions, or even, as I said, just measuring the performance of a PR campaign. So her piece online right now sort of discusses some of the prevailing KPIs that are aligned with four primary business goals that might be of interest to C-suite. It's a great article. It talks about digital reach and engagement, some of the metrics you can use there. These won't come as a massive shock to people listening to this. We're talking content views, shares, likes, comments, that sort of thing. If this is appropriate, or if you're looking over after an entire sort of marcoms unit, you know, there's a sales and marketing lead impact as well, or you could work alongside your marketing departments on that, and of course the rise of influencers and the ROI that companies who use influencers get. I know obviously there's, you know, some controversy around them, and there's also the move towards using micro influencers over big name individuals who charge a lot of money to cover perhaps a new piece of tech or what have you, and the sort of that blurred line between editorial and an advert, for instance, and also sample some KPIs then on things like loyalty and advocacy, you know, things like member testimonials and things like that. It's a really good piece. I really recommend everybody read it.
Well, we've totally dropped AVEs, and I know that aligning ourselves to the CIPR code of conduct, we're actually not allowed to report on AVEs, but it's becoming a challenge for accounts where we only look after PR to be able to demonstrate our value. We often compete against other forms of marketing which have clearer methods of reporting, especially when it comes to outcomes. It's very easy for us to report on outputs and to think about what we do and how we do it, how we engage with our audiences. But it's sometimes more challenging, especially for PR, to measure outcomes that might happen over a very long period of time. PR might be part of a decision-making process or be part of a prompt. So I think it's really interesting, and I think the key really is to not look at ourselves in isolation anymore. I think the beauty of AVE was that we were able to establish a mechanism which was fantasy land metrics that people semi-understood or saw the logic behind. And I think that was the key, really. It was a way of measuring against a criteria. The value was fantasy land in terms of what it actually was, but it was a way of measuring. None of us use it anymore, and I think it's been outdated for most of the time that we've been working in this profession. But I think it is important as we work and operate in more of a digital world. If we link back to the last piece, where the challenge of for comms practitioners is the changing and evolving social and digital landscape, we're competing or working alongside our partners in marketing who are able to demonstrate the value and impact that they have. And I think we as comms practitioners can no longer hide behind nice clippings that we send to our clients or to our bosses. We need to think much more broadly about how we can actually deliver change and impact our audiences through the activities that we do. So we need to be smarter. But I think the only way to do that is to demonstrate industry change, for people to work together to adopt basic practices that are common across all companies. I think that's the key. And that's certainly where things are moving. But I think the pace certainly needs to be accelerated.
Yeah, and I know that obviously AMEC, the International Association for Measurement and Evaluation of Communications, they've worked solidly for the last few years to not only roll out things like the Barcelona Principles, but also improve on them as time has gone on as well. And I think, you know, for me personally, you know, you've got to be looking at the quality of coverage a lot more now than you ever were before, and also align it with other metrics as well. Things like sentiment, quite frankly. I mean, we've all probably for the last few years looked at coverage sentiment, but I think you can have things like coverage quality alongside that, and that also provides an extra benefit potentially, which, you know, hopefully is another topic we'll be coming on onto in a future episode, which is crisis communications. In that, for me, if you have a top quality outlet, and this can be either a national or one of your big players in the sector, for instance, if it was a piece of tech that was in one of the technology outlets, for instance, you know, say it's a review of a new gadget that you've got, the MUV of the site is high, but they pan it, then, you know, what does that mean? How do you react to that? If you have a national covering a particular failure or perhaps an incident, you know, that could potentially build up to becoming a full-blown crisis, it's better to sort of know as soon as possible. I think having those two measurements, a, you know, quality measurement and measuring alongside a measuring sentiment as well, means that you could probably a really interesting way to almost like an early warning system, if you like. So if you're getting a couple of outlets that are big or even sort of mid-tier that are negative in terms of sentiment towards you, and they have the possibility of, you know, breaking to those top tier, breaking international, then I think the sooner you have that information, the better prepared you can be.
Fantastic. John, your news story relates to an event that's happening on the 9th of 10th of May. I'm going to put you on the spot and I just want a one sentence answer, and then I'll give you mine afterwards. PR conferences, worth their salt or a waste of time?
I've been to many conferences as a journalist, and I feel that on the whole, they can be useful. You have to be very aware and mindful that a lot of the speakers, and I'm not saying in specific conferences, I'm not going to be specific here, but, you know, I've certainly been to some conferences in the past outside of PR where they are nothing short of sales pitches. And for me, a conference speech, a talk, should be as valuable as a blog post. Blog posts should be sales pitches. They should provide knowledge and thought leadership rather than trying to sell your product or anything like that.
Couldn't agree more. Come to share, not come to sell.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and as you said, 9th and 10th of May, that's obviously PR Week's PR 360 communications conference. They've announced the first set of speakers and session topics. The theme of the year is on maximizing opportunities and minimizing threats. Some of the sessions are really interesting. They're measuring the impact of PR, whether PR can do it all, or whether we should try. And really interestingly for me, what the pitching process should look like in 2019. Now, I'm in-house, so for me, I've received pitches from agencies over the last few years, and indeed from other organizations as well, whether that is media monitoring agencies or whatnot. Having to give a pitch is something that I've not had to do for a very long time, and certainly not on this side of the coin as well. So I'd be fascinated to know how a pitching process in 2019 differs to a pitching process in, well, 2018.
I think that's the fascinating point. I think conferences, in my view, again, it's all about sharing content, not selling. But one of the key things for me really is the networking opportunity. So the opportunity to have a large number of experts from within their field in the room. And I think in order to get the value out of it, you need to be brave, bold, and go and network. And for me, that's quite difficult because I'm quite an introverted person. And so actually the idea of walking into a room of lots of people I don't know actually fills me with dread. But actually, the key thing for me from these events, where you've got a collection of comms people. I'm not sure what the collective noun of comms people is, but when you've got a collective room of PR practitioners, it's really about the conversations and the networking you have there. Because the only way for us to learn and develop is to connect with people and find out what they're doing. And I found certainly over the last few years that the comms industry, I think, has become increasingly more open. I think people are much more prepared to share their secrets, because the only way for all of us as a profession to get better is to share knowledge and learn from one another. And I think that's really encouraging. And one thing that I've been really pleased to see is the growth of influencers from within our profession. Actually, in the past, when we were starting out, it was very difficult. They tended to be, you know, one or two academics who wrote books a long time ago, whereas now we have a large number of really clear individuals who are doing fantastic initiatives, sharing their insights and giving their time, effort and professional experience to others for free, so that everyone can become better. And that's why it's such an exciting sector to work in at this time.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, on PR360, information can be found about the conference at pr-360.com, and tickets are available now.
Fantastic. But without further ado, we should launch into John's interview with Mike Sargent. So over to you, John.
Yeah, so we'll go and speak to Mike. I'm going to be honest here. It's episode 2. We're still finding our production feet. There was a slight disaster on my end with the questions. Not quite being recorded clearly. It was a phone interview with Mike. And so I've had to re-record, for the benefit of you lovely listeners, those questions. We'll get better at this, folks. Our guest today on the pod is Mike Sargent from Sargent Leadership Communications. Hi, Mike.
Hello, hi.
Welcome to the PR Hub podcast. These days you head up your own consultancy, but you've also had quite the amazing career before that as a broadcast journalist, including 13 years at the BBC covering everything from business and local government through to Iraq and the Arab Spring at the start of the decade. Looking back at that period, how do you feel and compare that to today's news environment, where social media is supercharging the news agenda faster than ever before?
Oh, gosh, yeah. Well, yeah, thanks for that kind description of my career. I did have a very interesting time in journalism, particularly the 13 years at the BBC, where I was lucky enough to cover some extraordinary events both in the Middle East and at Westminster and in the world of business. And I left the BBC because I'd kind of come full circle, had a fantastically interesting time, but couldn't just repeat the 18 years that I'd had all over again, and wanted to do something different. And also, journalism was changing. You're right to say that. And the reporters themselves were under more pressure to file more pieces for many, many more different outlets. And social media was starting to play a very, very big role. And when I was a journalist, I wasn't very comfortable on social media. I was very happy to talk to millions of people on the television or the radio, but less comfortable with the worlds of Twitter and Facebook and so on. And I think, looking back, that was probably a bit of a mistake. I could have built up an incredible Twitter following on the basis of my the platforms I had at the BBC. But anyway, yes, it was changing, and changing very rapidly. And I've had to come to a mastery of that, I hope, from a different dimension as an advisor now, rather than a broadcaster.
You followed the somewhat established route of journalist turned PR and comms expert. You left the BBC about 4.5 years ago, and for many journals, that switch is still referred to, even jokingly, as going to the dark side. Do you think PR is the dark side to journalism, and what do you think former journalists bring to the PR and communications industry?
No, it's the light side, of course, because journalism is really the dark side. In journalism, you're looking for death, disaster, destruction, scandal, resignation. Things going wrong tend to make the news. Things going wrong spectacularly and tragically tend to lead the news. You know, if it bleeds, it leads, was the old maxim in newsrooms. PR is on the light side, because you are looking for the positive in situations. You're looking for the best in people and in organisations. when people are trying to damage your story and damage your reputation in PR, you're thinking of ways to build it and defend it. Not by spin, not by lies, not by any untruths, but just by having a very clear and compelling version of your story and the person that you are. So I'm happier on this side of the fence, in that I'm involved with positive campaigns, with trying to help people to cut through with more clarity and impact and energy. And I do not look at the current situation in politics or anywhere in the world and think, I wish I was still a reporter. No, those days are behind me. In terms of the skills, though, I think very important skills of storytelling, which journalists have, which can be used in the public relations world. It takes quite a long time to figure out how to use those skills and even accept that you do have any skills, because when you first arrive in the PR world, you're blinded by new concepts, new ways of working, and new approaches, and a lot of new information. A whole world that you didn't know existed suddenly opens up before your eyes. But what I would say to journalists is just, you know, focus on your storytelling abilities, focus on your ability to read people and to bring people to the fore of any situation or any narrative. And I think therein lies the power of good public relations and good communication.
I mean, I actually really strongly agree with you when you describe PR and comms as the light side. In fact, it's one of the driving forces for me for leaving journalism a few years back after being a video games journalist and business tech writer for many years. I felt PR offered a pragmatism and even an optimism about the stories I could write about that I couldn't do on the journalism side. And at the same time, I feel journalism needs PR, PR needs journalism, and it's up to both sides to work together for a good result.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with that. And the whole hacks versus flax thing is just so dreary and utter nonsense. This idea that we're on opposite sides battling each other and PR people are trying to stuff their stories into journalists' publications and programs, and journalists are trying to pull up their defenses to PR, which is, you know, just the kind of corporate spin and the stuff they want you to hear rather than the truth. And I find all of that stuff very tedious. I think the, you know, good journalism and good public relations are actually on the same page, in that they need to produce something that is interesting, and that's the beginning and the end of it. If you want to pay people to take your messages, that's fine. It's not very effective, but it's one way of doing it. But great public relations and great communications is where you find really interesting things to say and to do. And you get people talking about you in a good way. And, you know, journalists like that, PR people like that. And when PR people are able to give journalists that, it makes their life a whole lot easier. So I think, yeah, the problem is probably with, you know, bad practice or lazy journalists just accepting whatever they're given, and poor quality PR practitioners who just think they can, you know, shove endless press releases under the noses of journalists and expect to achieve results for their clients. And those days, if they ever existed, are certainly gone.
Absolutely. How much do you feel that much of the public perception of the PR industry is through the TV shows that they watch? You know, fictitious shows like Ab Fab or The Thick of It. It's something my co-host Adam and I discussed in our previous episode. And neither of those shows portray the industry in a positive light. Do you feel that the reason for negative perception towards the industry comes from a lack of positive representation of the industry? I mean, I can think of things like The West Wing and its pragmatic comms team as one of the few examples to counter that.
Yeah, it's kind of ironic that an industry that is all about reputation has done such a bad job of influencing its own reputation or managing it in any way. And I think, yeah, public relations has an image problem. PR, as you know, two letters, has negative connotations in the minds of many people. Just think of the phrase, you know, that's just PR, or it's a PR attempt to do something. You know, you mentioned Ab Fab and The Thick of It, and I think some people think, you know, PR is just a combination of champagne-fueled parties and manic political spin and, you know, people trying to spray a good image on a terrible product or a terrible organisation or even a terrible person. I think that public relations in its good form, you know, let's get back to basics here. What is it? Relations with the public. So all you're doing is taking a person or an organisation or a product and trying to explain to people who are in the audience why this product or person or organization could matter to them in some way, or could be interesting to them in some way, could get them talking, you would hope, in a positive way. And I think all of those things that PR has been doing so well for so many years aren't very widely understood. It's interesting you put the West Wing in, and I think in America there's not such a big image problem with PR. There's definitely an image problem in Britain, and I think it was the case, you know, in the 90s already. But what really stuck the knife into PR was this whole idea of spin and spin doctors and those within you know, Downing Street and elsewhere, who kind of seemed to become bigger than the story, seemed to be trying to just get headlines rather than actually do real things. And the result of all of this, you know, years of kind of bad publicity for public relations, has been that most agencies don't even talk about PR. They don't have the letters PR on their websites. They call themselves strategic communications consultants, or you know, influencer engagement specialists, or content providers. So, you know, I'm in my book, PR for Humans, is a slightly sort of cheeky attempt to confront this head on, and a challenge to the PR world to get its act together, start focusing on what it does best, which is storytelling, and influencing reputation through stories. And at its heart, that's very simple human activity that's been going on since the beginning of human history and will be going on for the rest of recorded time as well. And those principles don't change, even if the world changes and technology changes.
I'm glad you mentioned the book. It's out later this month. It's called PR for Humans: How Business Leaders Tell Powerful Stories. As you said, it discusses a number of principles you've identified in your time that leads to effective leadership, like clarity, humility, and context. How, and perhaps more importantly, why is it so essential in the modern PR and comms era to understand and execute on those principles?
Well, I think because we're talking about human communication with other human beings. And so, you know, the public relations world is very focused on organizations and processes and channels and, you know, KPIs and engagement maps and stakeholder grids and all that stuff. And that's all good and fine. But what we need to get to is the story. And we're often, when we look at it from the perspective of the audience, we're often looking for the person. You know, we look at a government, we don't see a government in all its complexity. We see the Prime Minister or the President. Or, you know, we look at a company, we don't see all the complexities of what the company does. We see who's the CEO, who are the human beings working in this company, which human beings are actually going to be buying the products or services and connecting with this business. So what I've tried to do in the book is to say, okay, let's reframe everything in public relations with one clear thought, which is, where's the human? And if the human bit's gone AWOL, if the leader can't articulate the message, if we can't look at a company and see clearly who the people are working for the company and why they work for that company, then it'll be increasingly hard for companies to have good reputations. So I see the PR at its most powerful is where you get the intersection between comms, corporate comms on one side, and leadership on the other side. And where I position the book and where I position myself is right at the intersection. So you can't have one without the other. You know, if you want good coverage, you need good leaders. If you want good leaders, you need good communications. And those principles are where I would advise people just to have a look. They're not, you know, they're not Ten Commandments or anything, but just to have a look at their communications through a slightly different lens and just check against whether they are matching some of those aspects. And if they're not, then I think there's a very easy way in which they can make their communications more powerful.
And I guess it's also vitally important for people to realise that PR is more than media relations. It's also about things like internal communications. You say about company reputation, and I think that's something that's often an element that's forgotten about. Business leaders don't effectively communicate things like company objectives and the rationale behind those objectives.
Oh, yeah. I think you could make a strong argument that internal comms is more important than external comms, because if you are communicating well with the people inside the business, if they really understand, you know, why you're there, why they're there, what the mission is, what's bringing you all together as a collection of human beings, then those people will become much better ambassadors for you through their own social media activities and just through their own conversations. So I think, get everyone on side, get a happy organization which knows where it's going, that has comfort with the leadership of the business. And then the story almost, forms itself to a large degree. So I think that's very, very important. Look inwards before looking outwards. And that goes at a corporate level, but also for the individual. So people might say, well, why am I not a great public speaker? What can I do to project more powerfully to my audience? And I would always turn that around and say, okay, well, if you want to be a more powerful public speaker, the work starts inside you. And then you've got to try and externalize some of that. But if you're not really clear at your core, who you are, what you believe in, what you're about, what matters to you, where you've been vulnerable and where you've failed, all those sorts of things, then it's very, very hard to stand on a platform and really connect with an audience, because then you're just talking out to them. Whereas if you can look inside yourself, show a little bit of who you really are, then you start to form very, very powerful bonds with audiences. And that's where this work gets very, very exciting for me, because we're going quite deep into human nature here. We're not just thinking about PR as some kind of transactional thing provided by some mega agency. This is about looking inside, the hearts and the minds of human beings, which is endlessly fascinating. And for me personally, it takes the job of a PR advisor into a whole new direction, much deeper, much more substantial, and ultimately more powerful.
So that's the end of episode 2. Thank you for listening. It'll be really great to hear your feedback, whether you think we're doing things right or you think we could be doing things differently. We'd love to hear your feedback. So please do tweet us at PR Hub. And also, if you would like to, please feel free to rate the podcast on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to PR Hub. Thank you for listening. I've been Adam Tuckwell.
And I'm John Wilcox. Once again, thanks again for listening. And those likes, rates, reviews, subscriptions, absolutely vital in raising the pod's visibility, which means more PR and comms professionals get the opportunity to see the podcast and hopefully download, listen, and like it too. Mike Sargent can be found at The Mike Sargent. Thanks very much for his time earlier on in the month. His book, PR for Humans, is available to pre-order now from Amazon, WH Smith's, Waterstones, and wherever else you get your books from. And it'll be hitting shelves from April 18th.
Thanks for listening.
Cheers.